Hello, diamond beauties and interdimensional beings of light. It's Lisa here, your mystic guide, inviting you to come and take a ride with me as we journey through space and time. Our mission is to create conscious content for 1111D, sharing resources of light for the new reality. Welcome to the Buddhist Biohacker.
Buddhist Biohacker would like to thank our partners Block Therapy, Purity Coffee, Dry Farm Wines, Omnia, and 2-1 Photography. Information can be found on lisamgunshore.com. Join our forum at miwi.com/Buddhist Biohacker and watch live on YouTube on the Buddhist Biohacker channel.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are across the world, and welcome to another episode of the Buddhist Biohacker. We are on a mission to create conscious content for the new reality and where our planet is headed. And my name is Lisa Gunshore, and I am always your host and guide on this journey that we are all on together. And I am absolutely honored to have our guest with us today for this particular podcast. I want everybody to give a nice warm welcome to Alakananda. Welcome. It's just a joy to have you here. And I just can't say enough. To give everyone context, I met Alakananda a year ago via a yoga program that I was in. I had heard about her and I went to her for some health support. And it just really, Ayurveda is such an important integral part of my journey. And Alakananda's support was compassionate and warm and clear and direct as well. So welcome. And I just want you to take some time at the very beginning here to just share with everyone who you are.
I didn't quite hear what you said because it kind of came in and out a little bit.
Oh no. Yeah, if you want to share a little bit about who you are, that would be awesome.
Okay, so nowadays I'm Alakananda Ma, but a long while ago I was Olivia Hudis, and I was born in a very small town in Leicestershire in the United Kingdom. In a different time and a different place, in a time when women put on afternoon dresses that were silk and had sleeves to go and have tea with each other in my small town. I was born to a Jewish father and Christian mother, so I always inherited a coming together of faiths. My father pretty much created a family religion that was a combination of Jewish rituals in the home and devotion to the Celtic saints of Scotland, especially Saint Columba. That he made us a flag. We had our own flag. We had our own way we called each other. It was a very interesting way to grow up. We had a family motto, which was adventure together. So I think I took that and ran with it and had many adventures. When I was a teenager, I was walking home from rowing on the River Orwell. We'd moved away from our small town to a larger provincial town named Ipswich, which was on the coast, pretty much. So I had an oar on each shoulder, and I was going to the boat shed with the oars when I was stopped by a voice which said, "You are going to be a healer, and you're going to go to a strange land, and you're going to heal people." So I went home and I said, I'm going to be a doctor. And my dad said, no, you shouldn't be a doctor because you're a poet type. You're not the doctor type. And I said, I'm going to be a doctor. God said so. So I did. I went to med school. I went to the same medical school in London where my grandfather started work at 14, taking care of the cadavers in the anatomy lab. And later, he actually sort of was one of the people that founded the profession of being a lab technician and helped to develop the EKG. So I went there as a medical student instead of as a teenage cadaver technician. And I graduated from there. It was kind of a struggle because it was never quite a fit. But looking back with hindsight, I'm immensely grateful for my teachers who grew up in the great days of clinical medicine before there was imaging. And really knew how to do clinical diagnosis. I can see how much I did learn from them, even if oftentimes I hated it at the time. After medical school, I did my residencies. You have to do to go from, you pass your exams, but then you're provisionally registered, and then to be registered, you have to go and work for the National Health Service. I found good jobs that were only 80 hours a week instead of 100 hours a week. It was great.
Oh my God.
In another small town in rural Suffolk, in Bury St. Edmunds. And at the end of that, I felt that I couldn't get the contemplation and the action together. And that working 80 hours a week, I would like fall asleep on my prayer stool.
Oh, God.
So I went and tried my vocation in a Trappist abbey. If you've heard of Thomas Merton, that was the same order that Thomas Merton was in.
Oh, beautiful.
And that was really great in a lot of ways, but it was also the first time in my whole life I'd been away from Jewish people, like completely. Completely away from other Jewish people in like totally a white Christian world. Wow. And that was very, very different. And also everyone else in the Abbey had been there as long as I had been alive. So they didn't really understand the then young people of the day. And we had a different perspective in life because we were born after the bomb. So we didn't believe the world was solid. I guess our generation were all destined to be Buddhists because we knew that which could be destroyed with 4 minutes warning could not be real, right, or solid.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was there for a year and a half, but it just wasn't quite a fit because of the – I loved it in a lot of ways, but because of the reasons I said – it wasn't quite a fit, so I left there, and I was in London. I was working as a play therapist for a blind girl, and then my sister came to visit me, and she had just been to an exhibition at the Royal Academy of Indian Art, and she came to my flat, and the UK an apartment is called a flat, my little box room, basically, where I was staying. Which was full of art I'd been doing. And she looked at my art and it was all these like sculptures and paintings of these people with three heads and four arms and things. And she said, you're doing Indian art. You should go to India. I have a lot of faith in my little sister. So I went out and booked a ticket to India.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
So I booked a ticket to India, and while I did the way we do stuff in my family, I did some preparations. I talked to my counselor who was counseling me from, you know, the whole upset of having left the Abbey. And she said, well, you should go and see Don Bede Griffiths. And I also, in my reading, I heard about Ayurveda and pulse diagnosis. Just something you read in a book, but it jumped off the page. one day I will do this. This is what I will do. So I went to India with a little black book with one address, which was John B. Griffiths in Shantivanam in Tamil Nadu in South India. So in short order, there I arrived. And within 3 weeks of being there, I met this person, a young man. This gets romantic here. I met a young man, just a few years older than me, with long hair that was kind of matted. And he wore a waist cloth that a rat had eaten a big hole in. And he had an instrument that was made of a gourd and a bamboo stem. And he had actually gotten lost. He was supposed to be meeting someone else and doing some singing. And we were doing some singing, practicing for Easter. And he sat down and we started singing to each other, which we've been doing ever since.
Oh, I love that story.
So once I met him, I kind of knew right away, this is your soulmate. Oh. I did know right away, this is your soulmate. He mostly seemed to think I was one of all the interesting people that he was meeting on his journeys. So we met, he told me some good places to go to, and then he took off. We haven't exchanged an address. There isn't really an address to exchange when you're wandering around India.
Yeah.
So I met my soulmate. We've hung out together for a few weeks, and he's taken off to I know not where. But he told me to go to this ashram in Pune, Krista Prema Seva Ashram. That was a very good place. So I went to live there. Lo and behold, within 3 weeks, he arrives with a woman.
Oh, no.
Who promptly leaves him because she thinks it would be better to go back to her rich boyfriend. Because he will be able to buy her more things rather than hanging out with this sadhu, this renunciate, with a rat hole in his lungi and a musical instrument and a few pictures of gurus. Anyway, once I met, he was then called Francis, now he's called Sadananda. Once I met him, he was really the only person I ever needed to meet because he brought me to Alandi. This is why this is called Alandi Ashram and Alandi Ayurveda Gurukula, because he brought me to the village of Alandi, which is a temple town, and he introduced me to a simple old man who wore a loincloth, whose name was Raghudas. Not like when you think of gurus, you think of like darshan and queues and ashrams and like all this stuff. It was just a simple old man with maybe 100 disciples, which meant I got to spend tons. And the moment I saw him, I knew I had always been looking for him. Forever, I had been lying on the floor of the abbey crying because I wanted to meet him. I didn't even know there was such a thing as a guru. So when I came to India, I thought if I was really lucky, maybe I would learn to meditate. And if I was really, really incredibly lucky, maybe I'd meet a guru. Well, I did. I did meet someone who redefines human potential. Someone unlike any other person I ever met in my whole life. Just someone that simply sat and radiated unconditional love. Someone totally simple. And that changed my life in so many ways. And he resolved a lot of my problems because he looked at me and he said, don't worry, Yeshua and I are one. Jesus and I are one. It's all one. We're all one. So that's that coming together of the different faiths. But the other person that Sadananda introduced me to was Dr. Lad, who now has the Ayurvedic Institute. And Dr. Lad, in my opinion, is really the one important person that brought authentic teachings of Ayurveda to the United States. And I would not be who I am or where I am today without Dr. Lad. So Sadananda, I got dysentery. Sadananda brought me to meet Dr. Lad. I met Dr. Lad. I looked at him and I burst into tears because in all my years at medical school, I never met a doctor that I wanted to be when I grew up. The moment I met Dr. Ludd, I knew I would be Dr. Ludd when I grew up. Mm-hmm. And I think in my own way, I am in my own way, I think I fulfilled that. You can't be someone else. But if Dr. Ludd was a homeopathic doctor, I would have studied homeopathy, but he was an Ayurvedic doctor, so that's why I started initially studying with him, and I'm still studying. There's so much to learn. That was 1980, and there's still so much to learn about Ayurveda. So, yeah, that was like the pivotal time in my life, was those 5 years in India and meeting those three people. Sadanand, my soulmate, the most funny and interesting and spontaneous and spiritual person, and Raghu Das, my guru, and Dr. Ludd. That's how it all started, and that's also really how my journey with Ayurveda started, and kind of, not that I left Western medicine behind, it informs me every day, and all the wonderful things that I learned from what I now realize were actually very good teachers at my medical school, and very good learning. But yeah, that's how it all started.
That story is so beautiful. And I just, was almost moved to tears hearing you talk about meeting your guru. I could feel the Shakti of that. And thank you for sharing that. It's really beautiful. And I'm in my very first year of the study of Ayurveda, and Dr. Ladd's books are just incredible gifts. So I honor him and you for all that you have learned, because there is so much to learn. It's just never ending. I think I've read more books about it this year, and I feel like I've barely scratched the surface. So it's just such a beautiful piece. And I'd love for you to share a little bit about your, after all these years, you know, how would you define Ayurveda for the folks out there who maybe don't know even what we're talking about?
I think that Dr. Ludd wrote a little purple book, Ayurveda, the Science of Life, which was one of the very first things to come out in the English language. And despite all the other books that have been written, including by him, three great textbooks and all the other books, that's still like the book. He packed so much into that little book. And in that little book, he explains Ayush is life. And not just life in the sense of being alive, longevity of life, quality of life. And Veda is the knowledge, the science. So when those words come together, the way Sanskrit works, Ayush plus Veda, it becomes Ayurveda. And it is the science of life. It says in the text that Ayurveda teaches us about the causes of being happy or unhappy, and the things that are suitable and unsuitable for us. So that there is a whole stream of Ayurveda that is called Svasthavritta, that's really about how to lead a wholesome life. Svasthya means health, means standing in yourself, experiencing well-being. And that's the part of Ayurveda that talks about our daily routines, our seasonal routines, the ways that we can maintain our health. But then there's the other whole body of knowledge, books and books and books and books about how we can treat our illnesses. And of course, in its day, Ayurveda was medicine. It wasn't alternative or complementary. It was what there was. People did surgery. People treated everything. Nowadays, we have Western medicine, biomedicine, that is like the standard medicine that's practiced, and that is very good for lots of things. like nowadays, surgery, which was started by Ayurveda, has been taken over by Western medicine, with the addition of anesthesia, antibiotics, and asepsis, which means that you can have things like hip replacements and heart transplants and not die from blood poisoning and not have to be held down by four strong men while you have the surgery and so on. Ayurveda, I feel, is still very helpful for more chronic conditions, or conditions that don't yield so well to Western medicine, or that someone wants additional ways to feel better. So nowadays, we're either practicing with the like health counseling, like how to live a healthy life, and then also especially working with more chronic illnesses, or working hand in hand with the Western medicine doctors as well.
Yeah. One of my questions is, here we are in this unprecedented time, lots and lots of things changing in the world. And I find that our spiritual practices and our daily routines are really important right now to keep us focused and grounded. What would you say are the most important Ayurveda practices that folks can practice? Like, what can we do on a daily basis right now to stay healthy and grounded during all of this time of transition?
One thing that I've found has been very helpful is just the regularity of routine. And that's very much emphasized in Ayurveda since we've been in this lockdown. Like us in Colorado, us older people, we've been under stay-at-home orders for almost 200 days. You can go for medical attention, or if you have to go to the store, if no one can go to the store for you, it's not recommended. And you can go for a walk and be outside, but you can't go visiting people or go out to things if there was even anything to go out to. So the upside of that is it really does support us having regular routines. And I think when so many things are shifting and changing and falling apart, just having that routine, just in the teachings on daily routines in the text, the first thing that's emphasized is get up in Brahma Muhurta. Get up before the sun. Get up while it's still dark. Enjoy that quiet and beautiful time that's so refreshing to us. And then by the same token, that means depending how much sleep you feel you need, you have to get to bed a little bit earlier so you can get up in that time. And then try to have those meals also at regular times. So if we can just maintain a routine when so many things are changing all around us, that's a very, very, if you're talking about an Ayurvedic practice, when we have a lot of things that shift and change and fall apart, people losing their jobs and the kids are going to school at home and like everything's like, keeps changing around. We want to, that provokes vata, that provokes the wind and the mobile qualities. So we balance that by just trying to have regular routines that work for us. And we have a unique opportunity, those of us that are staying at home, working from home and so on, where we really can focus on having those routines. That's one very simple thing.
Yeah, beautiful. And I so agree with you. I'm very disciplined with my routine, and I think it saved me this year with all the changes and things happening. So I absolutely agree with you. I would love to talk just a little bit about pulse diagnosis, because I think it's amazing and it's complicated. And I think, you know, it'd be fun to just hear from you, you know, to share with everyone a little bit about what that means and what it is, and if there's anything you want to share about it with folks.
So pulse diagnosis, as best as I understand it, it's a tradition that was passed down through different family lineages in India. It's more than the way we use the pulse in Western medicine, where we're really checking to see if the pulse is coming in a regular rhythm. And we're learning things about the heart, the blood pressure, and the lungs that we can learn from the pulse. Those old cardiologists that were training me in med school could assess the blood pressure from the pulse, and they could tell all kinds of things about the heart from the radial pulse and the carotid pulse. So already there's a lot that's being learned in that regard. But when you come to Ayurvedic pulse reading, you can pretty much determine everything that's going on in the body from feeling the pulse. It will tell you about the three doshas, vata, pitta, and kapha, which is the way that we really think about a balance, wellness, and illness in Ayurveda, what your constitution, your innate balance of vata, the airy humor, pitta, the fiery one, and kapha, the earthy, watery one, the ways that they've gone out of balance, and then many, many intricate things, subdivisions of all of those doshas. We look at organs too, adapting that from the way it's done. In Chinese medicine, we look at the seven layers of tissues, like your blood and your muscles and your bones and all the different layers of tissues. There's many, many things that we can determine by feeling the pulse, because we're connecting with another person. And there's many techniques and methods of pulse reading. The one that I learned, obviously, is coming from Dr. Ladd. He's written about it in his book, Secrets of the Pulse. It's not the way, it's a way. There's other traditions, there's other lineages, there's other ways that it's done. This is the way that I learned and the way that I've been doing it in the last 30 years. And got the teachings from him and sort of took and run with it and developed it, because you build experience. You see, as someone comes in with this known thing and the pulse feels like this, and the next time someone comes in and the pulse feels like this, you're like, I think you have hepatitis C. Can you go get a test? And it's right, because you felt that before. So it's a feedback between your experience and what you felt before, and then what you imagine you're feeling at the moment. It's a way of connecting. It's a subtle and contemplative art. In some ways, I like have no idea how it works. None.
I was amazed at when I came and saw you last year and you did the pulse reading. There were so many things, even emotional things, that you were able to speak to that were happening with me. And so it's an incredible art and beautiful. And how much of that do you think is coming from your intuition also, and just the knowing through your practices?
I think it's with all these tools, like if you use astrology, if you use tarot, if you use any of these tools, which that's a method by which you're attuning to a person, you do get other information, but it's also just these things are actually being said in the pulse, mm-hmm. as well. It's kind of a combination of feeling it in the pulse and feeling like I've got a little television there that's like showing me like things about the person.
I love it. Well, it was very accurate for me, and I've read books on the pulse diagnosis and working on that myself and honing that skill, because it's really an incredible, incredible skill. And there's a lot the body has to say.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the ashram, the Nalandi ashram, because there's kind of these different compartments of support that you offer. And I know this school is so important, and I want to talk about that. But I'd first love to hear about the clinic, if you want to share a little bit with everybody about what the clinic is and what you guys do there. And I know what I've experienced. So
we'll back up a little bit to, because you said Nalandi ashram. And I told you what Nalandi is. It's a village, it's a temple town where our guru resided from the age of 16 until he died. Yeah. It's actually the place where 700 years ago there was a great saint, poet saint, Sant Janeshwar, who resided in that village. And at the age of 21, he was buried alive in Samadhi. He was entombed in Samadhi. And everyone believes, like Dr. Lard believes, I believe, everyone believes that he's still alive. Even hundreds of years after he was entombed, he appeared in a dream to another saint, Saint Eknath. And he said, "You have to come and help me because there's a tree root getting in my way. Dig here." Because everyone had forgotten about where Saint Ganeshwar's tomb was. So Saint Eknath came, he followed the instructions in the dream, and he dug there and he found the tomb and he opened it, and there was a radiant youth seated in meditation with a manuscript on his lap. And Saint Eknath took the manuscript. And this is where I don't see how the story could be not real, because this manuscript was the earliest thing written in the Marathi language, and linguistically it had to be written then 700 years ago. Saint Eknath couldn't have made it up. And if anyone made it up, I bow at their feet, but yeah. It has, the story kind of has to be real. So he cut the tree, and you can still see one of the taproots of the tree is cut and it's leaning, because that root had to be cut. And that manuscript was brought forth. That's the Bharatha Deepika, or the Nyaneshwari text that everyone in Maharashtra loves so deeply and such a treasure trove of teachings. So Sant Nyaneshwar used to appear to our Guru Raghadas just like a person standing in front of him and give him teachings.
Wow.
So that's why he stayed there at Nalandi. And that's why this is Nalandi Ashram. And when I was finally leaving India, I couldn't leave without taking permission to go. I went to my guru's sister and his spiritual mother in two different villages, and they both said the same thing. You go to America with Sadanand and you create an ashram for Raghudas, and because he lived in Nalandi his whole life, you must call it Nalandi Ashram. So that's why it's an ashram and it's Nalandi Ashram. So we arrived in America with $80 and like saris and chapels, like sandals, and it was 20 below or 30 below in the middle of winter. And we had no idea how to get an ashram. The first ashram was a teepee in a friend's backyard in North Boulder. The second ashram was a little back street apartment in Tucson, Arizona, where at least it wouldn't be 20 below. And the third ashram began in this building here, but it's actually a duplex, and it actually started in the three-room basement. And we'd have 45 people, forget that, in this little basement section, garden level section. And gradually it sort of expanded to occupy this whole building. And so kind of the core of it is that we do the Agnihotra, sunrise and sunset fire ceremony, bigger fire ceremonies. The healing fires are the essence of the Vedic teaching. That's like the core of it, and coming together to meditate, sharing, and I can't even imagine how many hours Sadhananda and I have meditated together. I just sat together. And like he says every day, you know, you're just a beginner and you don't know anything about meditation. Even though he's a meditation teacher, he says that every day it's a new beginning. And what do you know? Nothing, actually. Your mind is just as crazy as ever. And you're starting anew. So that's how it started. And because Ayurveda was always a part of it from the beginning, the clinic always was there from the beginning. And then and the school started, everything started organically. If we had done a feasibility study, we would have never started. It isn't feasible to do this, but we've been doing it. We've been here for 30 years fulfilling our dreams. Lots of people have been touched. If any one of us thinks about how many lives we've touched, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, I'm one of them. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful space. And you just have so much compassion. I mean, the warmth. I felt like I was coming to see my mom. And you took care of me during that time. And that's what's so beautiful about it is you really feel held. And when you're going through anything that's chronic, at the time, I was in the middle of a health crisis last year, and, you know, it's scary. And to be in a space that you feel held and loved and supported is so important. So I'm thankful for that, for sure. Oh, no, it froze. It froze. See if we can get you back. Hold on, everyone.
So it's getting a little.
Yeah, it froze.
A little difficult to hear you.
All right, you're back. Can you hear me now?
Hello?
Can you hear me now? Hello?
Yeah. It got a little different. You were saying beautiful things, but then I couldn't hear them very well.
That's okay. Yeah,
I think my computer.
But you're back now, it seems. So that's good.
Yeah.
You know, I was just saying it's just a beautiful space that you hold for us when we're sick and scared and worried and to be supported and held and to feel like you're going to be able to heal is so valuable. So I'm so grateful for that. And I know many, many people are. I would love to hear about your school. I'd really love to hear about what you're doing with your school and how we can support the school too.
Yes, so that's really been a journey because one of the things that's come forth for me has really been that I want Ayurvedic education to be at a very high standard in this country. Maybe not the same as the education in India, which is basically modeled on a British medical school, because we won't have the same scope of practice, but it should be very good education. Like you said, there's a lot to learn. We can't just be only learning a little bit because there's a lot to learn. So the school did really just, it first started in the mid-90s when Nita Desai, she's now practicing Ayurveda in Boulder County, when she showed up and wanted to learn. So people just started gathering together and we started doing some classes. And then by 1998, it was like formally a gurukul and we were having formal classes. And that went on until went on for a few years, and then sometime in the 2000s, there was a national downturn in herbal education, and it kind of faded out. And then in 2008, this young woman, Lauren, who had just graduated from Naropa, and I'd been seeing her as a patient her whole time at Naropa. She graduated with her yoga degree, and she showed up and she wanted to learn. And so somehow in 1998, it all started up again with the second iteration of the Gurukul, and we had a really fantastic couple of groups of students. And that first group of students, they studied for 2 years, and then they said, but it's not enough, we refuse to leave. We need more students like that. Those are the best students. Cece and Heidi and everyone, those are the best. Cece's still on our board. She's still refused to leave. Now she helps us to run, you know, at the board level. So because they refused to leave, we extended the program. It naturally became a 4-year program because it needed to be. And now it's 4-year, more than 4,000 hour program, about half of which is clinical, because that's where we put our learning into effect, through the clinical side. And then there's the NAMA, the National Ayurvedic Medical Association. I've been working a lot with NAMA, with the standards committee, setting all of the educational standards. And that's been tremendously supportive, because that is a community that supported me in my vision of high standards of Ayurvedic education. That's an organization that stands for constantly raising the standards. And then now with the NAMA, we're also developing NAMAC, which I'm on the accreditation council, but we're now actually working towards accredited schools. So my big vision for the Gurukula and how I see it will have longevity, and hopefully longevity beyond me, because my time on earth is limited now. that I want to see that accreditation council, accreditation bodies have to become accredited themselves by the Department of Education. I want to see that accreditation council succeed and become recognized by the Department of Education, so that we will then be accredited by an accredited accreditor, so we can actually become a college. Because if people can't be actual doctors with an actual doctoral degree, this is not really going to work for the graduates in the long term. Because if you're sort of a doctor, but you can't really call yourself a doctor because you don't actually have a doctorate, it's okay in an emergent stage, but it can't go on being like that. People need to have actual doctorates, which means having the recognized accreditation body and having the actual moving step by step towards being an accredited college. Right now we're an occupational school, but that's a stepping stone.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's amazing, because that's definitely, for me personally, that's what I'm hoping to achieve in this lifetime myself. So I love hearing that, because it's so important to have all of the pieces and parts to be able to be successful in helping people heal and doing it in right action. So that's awesome.
Right.
Beautiful. How can folks help the ashram? How can they support your mission? How can they support the clinic and the school? Like, what are some of the ways that folks can help out?
Well, people can definitely support by donating. All donations, large and small, are equally appreciated. But when you know someone's at the lowest end of your sliding scale and they write a check for $10 and put it in the mail, you appreciate that from the absolute bottom of your heart, because it expresses so much gratitude and appreciation, and it helps tremendously. So people can go to the website, alandiashram.org, and click on the donate button. We also have a GoFundMe. People can go there or tell people that don't know about us about the GoFundMe campaign. I'd normally say just show up and volunteer, but with COVID and stay at home, it's a little bit different with that part right now. And normally speaking, again, right now our ceremonies are very limited to just us and a couple of close people in our bubble, that, and then outside and 6 feet apart and everything. But normally, come to Monday night healing chants. That's where it's all happening, where we chant the healing mantra 108 times and we pray for everyone that's sick and the whole world. Come to our ceremonies, come and connect. It's just a little different right now.
Yeah, for sure.
Follow us on social media. Definitely donate and also support NAMA. Support NAMA's efforts for NAMA for accreditation, because it all works together. We have to raise the funds for the accreditation to work for Alandi's vision and the vision of the other schools to move forward, for the students to have good prospects for the future. That's what we need them to have good careers. Everyone shouldn't have to be a renunciate. I remember when we were getting together, starting the accreditation council, the group of us were chatting among each other and someone said, so do you earn your living by Ayurveda? And I'm like, yeah, but I'm a renunciate. I don't have a car. I don't have an iPhone. And I don't have kids or college to pay for. Everybody shouldn't have to be a renunciate.
Mm-hmm.
Right? People should be able to earn their living during Ayurveda.
Yeah. Beautiful. I think one of my last questions for you is, I would love to hear what your advice is during this time. You know, what do you want to say to everyone about this time and this year and words of wisdom?
Metta. This is a time when we need to practice loving kindness, because it's very easy for us to feel depressed and us to feel sad when so many people are dying and losing their jobs and people in the world are being forced into poverty. A million people have died in the world. To keep our minds light and buoyant, we do this through metta, through the practice of loving kindness. Even the very most simple form of that is simply breathe in, may I be happy. Breathe out, may all beings be happy. Just even practice that a few minutes each day.
Yes. Oh, I really appreciate you coming on today and being accessible. And I was so excited to show you with everyone, because I just think you're such a special, special being. And I'm just really grateful that you came on. I really appreciate it so much.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you so much. It's been lovely to talk to you.
Oh. It's just been a pleasure, and we've had such a great audience. And everybody listening, I do hope you go to the alandiashram.org and give them a donation and check out the school. There's a lot of you who are either practicing Ayurveda or interested in it that watch the show. So the school has so many great resources and programs. So go on online and look at that as well. And Alakananda, I'm sure I will see you in the near future for my own health check, but I really, again, just so much love to you, and I just appreciate the work that you're doing in this world, and I'm so grateful to be able to share you with everyone today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Blessings.
Blessings to you as well. Thank you, everyone, and have an amazing, amazing day. Bye.
Bye.